Was macht eigentlich ein gutes Rollenspiel aus? Befindet sich das Genre vielleicht sogar in einer kleinen Identitätskrise? Was ist besonders wichtig bei einem Rollenspiel und welche Spiele dürfen sich so nennen, welche nicht? Darüber wollen wir heute sprechen und haben uns dafür eine wahnsinnige Runde eingeladen mit sehr, sehr vielen interessanten Gesichtern. Auf die kommen wir jetzt zu sprechen. Wir haben einmal Miles Tost vom CD Projekt. Nice to see you, man.
Hey, nice to have me.
Currently working on The Witcher 4.
Yeah.
You're allowed to say that right now, right?
Yeah, this is the one thing we can say. Like, until recently it was called Polaris, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, internally we still call it Polaris. I guess it's something you don't really lose, the code name. But yeah, like we've shown a bit of a tech demo so far. We've shown the trailer. Finally, we are deep in the territory where we can acknowledge the existence of it and talk about it. And I'm really happy about that.
Yeah, of course, you worked on Witcher 3. You worked on Cyberpunk.
So, yeah, I've been since 2013. I worked on Witcher 3, the expansions. And I was there all the way from, you know, development of Cyberpunk since 2015 to 2020 and beyond. And now I get to work on Witcher 4.
Cool. So next to you is Chris Parker from Obsidian.
Hey, everybody.
Nice to see you. It's good that you're here. So you're currently working on Grounded 2.
Yeah, I'm currently the game director on Grounded 2 for Obsidian Entertainment. We're working on that with Eidos Montreal, which is a pretty interesting experiment for us. To give you a little bit of my background, my first big game was Baldur's Gate and Baldur's Gate 2 with BioWare.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, I hope you guys have. There was recently another one in the series. You may have heard of it.
Yeah.
And then in 2003, I was one of the founders of Obsidian Entertainment, and I've gone on to work on basically every Obsidian game since then. And yeah, currently working on Grounded 2. Very exciting because we finally got it into people's hands just on June 29th, and it's very exciting.
Yeah, you've also worked on Fallout New Vegas then?
Yeah, I worked on, at Obsidian, I worked on Knights of the Old Republic 2, Neverwinter Nights 2, Fallout New Vegas, Alpha Protocol, South Park Stick of Truth.
Wow.
Armored Warfare, Pillars of Eternity 2. I never did work on Pillars of Eternity 1. Let's clear that up. Pillars of Eternity 2, Avowed, I worked on for a couple of years. I worked on The Outer Worlds 2, and now I'm in charge of Grounded. I think I got everything there. I've been really blessed in my career, actually, to have a lot of like really great opportunities.
Yeah, I have to ask you though, because for us it was quite the emotional moment to see New Vegas in the Fallout series for the first time. Did you see it? How did you feel to like see it on the in like a real TV show?
I mean, mixed emotions, right? Like,
yeah,
we would just like to go make another Fallout New Vegas.
I would be with you on that.
I know everybody wants to.
Yes. We want to play it.
Don't plan on it, all right?
Yeah.
But, you know, it would be amazing. But seeing it on TV, fantastic. Just super exciting to see something that you worked on at some point in your life get realized in a totally different media. That's super cool.
Cool. And also with us is Alex Michelin from Owlcat Games. You guys announced, you showed The Expanse Osiris Reborn on our Find Your Next Game show a few days back. What was the reactions you got so far? Are you happy with them?
Yeah, really happy. Since we announced, we got a lot of support. We still almost didn't show the game. We preparing a lot of surprises and announcements. It's really interesting for us to work first time on a third-person RPG after several isometric titles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that must be a challenge, of course, but we are so excited for the game. Before that, you worked on Pathfinder Kingmaker, for example, Rogue Trader.
Actually, started my career back in 99. I worked on many games, including Operation Silent Storm, and I was creative director for Heroes of Might and Magic 5. And after that, when Owlcat formed, I joined Owlcat, and since then, I worked on Boss Pathfinders, on Warhammer Rogue Trader, and now on Expanse.
So guys, it's quite humbling to be able to host this talk. I think it's going to be very interesting. Für euch da draußen, ihr könnt natürlich auch sehr gerne Fragen stellen. Ich glaube, das ist eine besondere Gelegenheit, mal mit so vielen großen Namen aus der Rollenspielszene zu sprechen. Dafür gerne Ausrufezeichen Frage benutzen. Dann werden die hier bei mir hoffentlich gespeichert und ansonsten in den Chat. Und I'm excited for this talk. So let's start with something very easy. For you personally, what makes a great RPG for you personally? What's the most important thing?
I think that really is a question that you can also ask many people and you'll always get a different answer.
I think that's kind of the point.
I feel for me, at its core, a good RPG allows the player to express themselves through a character, right? Or focuses on that. And that can be through your own character that you create or a character that exists, but the focus should be the mission statement of the designers behind it to allow the player to kind of get deep into role-playing that character. And the more tools you give the player, I guess, of this, and the stronger the tools are, whether it's character customization or, I don't know, like strong combat system, varied gameplay, choice and consequences in dialogue, right? These all add to that very core.
Yeah. Okay. For you, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to disagree. Probably won't disagree a lot with these guys. We both make Western RPGs, right? Yeah. So I guess if I had to put it in a nutshell, I would say choice and consequence. That has to do with character progression like you're talking about, but also, you know, what can I do in the world to sort of affect and change the world and make it feel like it's my own and that I've somehow had some influence over whatever happens in the game. So yeah, that's how I would boil it down. That can be expressed in so many different ways. Again, deep character progression, story branching, even how your companions interact with you if you have companions in your game. All of these things all affect that choice of consequence, and that's, I think, the beautiful thing about role-playing games for me.
And for you, Alex?
I can't agree more. It's all about choices and consequences and your decisions. Personally, it's great to see when all things combine in RPG, when story and mechanics and everything support each other. But sometimes it doesn't work that way, and I sometimes enjoy an RPG that is, for example, just great character progression and power, but story is and characters can be not so great, or vice versa, when it's mostly about story and characters and choices, while the mechanics lackluster. So RPGs can be different, but it's always about the choice.
Yeah, so it really is, like you guys said, a mix of story, but also character progression and systems. I think nowadays people are often like, if this doesn't have this, then it can't call itself an RPG. But really what it all comes down to is role-playing a character in whatever way, right? If it's story or if it's gameplay. Is it like, how do you balance these two things? Like, because you of course you always want to do as much as you can, you want to do both, but not all games do that.
I mean, I'll jump in and say, it's just a careful balancing act, and I think you have to have a very clear vision going into the game of what kind of game you're trying to make, and whether that's a fairly, like, linear role-playing game where you're going to make a lot of choices about how your character progresses or how you're going to try to overcome obstacles in that game, or whether it's an open world game where you can do kind of anything you want and you just want the world to react to how you're playing it. As long as you sort of set those out, you know, going in, I think you've already done, like, you know, half of your work on the game. If you don't know exactly what you're doing, that's going to be really, really hard. And if you try to do everything, that's going to be very, very hard. So, I think it's about establishing goals and what kind of role-playing game you want to make from the outset and then trying to execute on that.
Is it hard to allow for player agency? Because, of course, as a designer, you're designing the game. You want everything to feel tight and feel right, and then the player comes in and sort of breaks the game. But those are most of the times those are the best moments that somebody can have with a game to find like different ways how the game reacts to you. Is it hard to allow that player agency, even though it is so important?
I can basically jump in by saying it depends also on what kind of game you're making, right? Like if you are trying to, you know, hit the RPG notes by saying, okay, player self-expression through freedom and play is what the core of my game is, what we're trying to do, then yeah, it's gonna get really hard. But that's the sort of like, you know, challenge you set to yourself. And I find that it's super difficult once you actually get into that territory, because it's where a lot of fun happens. But for developers, cost-wise, that's also like a never-ending black hole of you know, work that you kind of spawn. Because where do you start with player agency, right? Like, especially now that games are getting more complicated. I see we're looking at one that looks very visually complicated, right? Like, the more you get into reactivity and all of that stuff,
yes,
the more challenging it becomes. And like asking yourself the question, where can you stop so that, you know, you balance believability versus what is feasible as a developer? It's probably one of the hardest parts of making agency-driven games, I guess.
We consider it super important, and in my opinion, you had to not only to plan for it, but allow it during your development. You want your narrative team to think in terms that allow player expression, not just writing a great story, but making a moment of big choices or consequences or just small things that will allow player to express themselves in different ways, like role play, for example. Will I be mean or nice or and sometimes it leads to consequences. Sometimes somebody will punch you if you're mean to him. But sometimes it's just, okay, and discussion will continue, but I'm still role-playing, and it's my agency, it's my character.
What for me always stands out in a game is when the developers have the courage to make things missable. Like, because many times a player would do something in a game, maybe kill a character or get wanted in a town and get blocked off for certain quests or certain paths. Or for The Witcher 2, for example, we had like the whole Act 2, which was different based on a choice. And it feels like this is getting rarer and rarer because, of course, if you develop something you want, people will see it. But this, for me, makes some of the magic that, you know, I can miss a lot of this stuff that other people maybe in their playthrough have seen.
I'm with you on that one. Like, it's almost, you know, like in the studio, I often have this conversation where I'm like trying to push for more of that. And, you know, there's so many compelling arguments also narratively, you know, where oftentimes you just, the better choice is to make something not missable, right? But like on a deeply personal level, when I play a game, I think there's a ton of value that comes in playing something where you know that there's stuff you can miss, because it makes the choices that I make actually so much more important and impactful, right?
Yeah.
I think the difficulty is to kind of create that in an environment where, A, you're not, you know, throwing away a shit ton of resources into an area where, like, you know, like, no one will see it. But also sort of making it so that the player doesn't feel cheated, right? So you always have to make sure that whenever you have, I don't know, let's say two consequences, like A versus B, that both of them feel like, yeah, I really got everything I wanted out of this. You know, I don't feel cheated. Because the worst situation is if you make a choice and then you learn of the other and you feel like, man, I kind of wish I had done the other one, right? Like,
but then we get to replay a game to see another choice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the other thing. Like, you can play games like Baldur's Gate, like, endlessly often. And I also think that's part of it, right? But on the other hand, personally, I don't have time to replay games. So for me, like, the first run, knowing that this one was my deeply unique one and there's more for me to discover, is usually, like,
Yeah, I always feel like this is my story. I don't want to read about it, then play it again and have a different one, because that's what my character went through.
Right? Yeah, talking about Baldur's Gate 3, like, I remember having finished my playthrough, and I was talking to my son, who had also beaten the game, and we literally were just comparing notes, like, oh, what did you do at the Druid? Oh, I did this at the Druid camp. I did this here.
I'm
like, what happens when you do that, right? We had our own stories that had been built, and that was because they put the effort into having things that you could miss and choices that you made that had consequence. And that's, you know, part of what made that game like so much fun and so exciting to play is because you did build your own story. And I agree with you. I never have time to play games again. I tried to play Baldur's Gate 3 again. I got about a third of the way through it, and I was like, I got to go do other stuff now.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, any game like that where you can really feel like you're building your own story, I think that's super exciting, right? Like, it's fun for players. And that means sometimes you have to develop content that other people are not going to see. That's just part of the game.
Yeah, that's the genre you choose. When we're making the game, we are planning for it. Essentially, that this part of the game will make for the players' decisions that only half of our audience, or probably tenths of our audience, will see. And that's what's great about RPGs. One time we went crazy with that, with Wrath of the Righteous, with all this mythic paths, and it was like our part of what we called USP, the unique proposition for the game, and we put a lot of resources there. For other games, we are trying to be more conservative and trying to find like more creative solutions, like different ways through quests, and not always like the whole bunch of content that you will be, like, tens of the story you will be missing. So, but yeah, if RPG doesn't have it, it's kind of, you're missing out on your decisions.
I kind of can, like, because I like to give context in this situation for also the people at home who are, like, trying to sort of understand how we as developers think about it, right? Is that sometimes when you're facing situations like this where it's a matter of, okay, do we create this exclusively or not? Then you kind of have to think, all right, we'll spend, I don't know, weeks, months on this piece of content. And the question is, if we do two of these, we could, do we get more value out of it than if we did one and really put effort into it, right?
Yeah.
Like, imagine it's a narrative key moment. And do you want that to be missable? Yes or no, right? And I think, since you mentioned Witcher 2, right, there the answer was clear, like, yeah, like, the entire experience should be shaped by that, right? But imagine, like, how different the game could look like. I'm not saying it's necessarily better or worse, right? If there had been one strand and all these resources were put on that exactly one experience, right? That would have been a great game for sure as well. It would have been a different game, right? It's just a question that you always have to ask yourself.
Yeah, I imagine that's not easy to answer, especially if you're not sure how it's going to turn out in the end to really decide on that. Since you guys are all doing games who put a lot of focus on decisions and consequence, and you also said it's very important for you, do you have a specific decision in one of your games that you're especially proud of, that you would say, we really did a great job on that, players really had to think about it, it was morally gray? Does something come to mind?
We were talking about Pathfinder, Wrath of the Righteous.
Yeah.
All this mythic paths that allow you to choose whether whom you want to be. You want to be, go through all the story, like being an angel and bring righteous fury, or be compassionate within the angel, or probably do something evil, go leech and everything. That was like, when we presented it internally to a team, it was like crazy storm of ideas, like, yeah, I want to be a leech, I want to do this and that and everything. We had to scale down ambition a little bit because it was like impossible to do. And then when we decided that we can, at certain point of the game, go a little further or betray one of your paths to become a devil, because devils is about betrayal. You can introduce them like that. That was the biggest one for me.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. I'm having a hard time thinking of something specifically.
I'm
thinking about the big picture, though. Like in the Outer Worlds, when we decided that we would have a pacifist option, and so you have to figure out how to let somebody get through the entire game by talking their way through it without murdering anything. And let's be honest, RPGs are mostly about murdering stuff, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, when you kind of come up with something like that, like how much scope are you actually taking on in your game? And it can be a lot, but it can be super, super rewarding for people that just want to try and experience that. So, I'm trying to think of like an actual decision point where it's like push the button or not push the button. But it is a decision as well, right? Yeah.
I mean, if you decide I want to do a pacifist run, that's like one of the biggest decisions because it's going to affect your play
everything
so much.
Everything you do, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's also such a bold decision to make. It's much more interesting to me, obviously also more costly than can I do stealth versus combat or so, because essentially it's still like two different ways of murdering people,
it's two
right?
different
like,
games, right?
Yeah. Like if you're just going for, like, yeah, we'll make completely, you know, authentic, original playstyle, which is literally don't fight, you talk your way through this. And actually commit to the dialogue options and the cinematic resource and all that stuff. I think that's incredible. It's so cool.
Well, if you guys need some more time to think about it, I can come back to it later also.
I can give one, but I'm not so sure it's so interesting for everyone else. Like recently, there's some Phantom Liberty spoilers here. In our recent expansion for Cyberpunk 2077, there's like the pivotal choice between, you know, two characters in one moment. And I really like that one, not because I think it's like a particularly clever choice or something, but for me as a developer, it's a really cool moment of learning.
Yeah.
Where in Cyberpunk, we had this, you know, coming from Witcher 3, we had this approach with Cyberpunk that, okay, like one thing that really worked for us in Witcher 3 was making a choice and consequence hard to read, right? Or harder to read, as in like you made a choice and the consequence would only come in like 2 hours later. And in the ideal case, you didn't even know that was the point of making the choice really, right? But the game would refer back to it and you had the connection and then sort of it felt like you really played like your own adventure. With Cyberpunk, we kind of thought, all right, great, let's double down on that and make everything even more, you know, harder to read and like what actually led to which and all that. And the idea was to create like a super seamless experience where whichever version you play, it's your movie that plays, right? And it's like completely polished sort of in that way. What happened actually is that players were not really able to understand where they had done decisions and what decisions led to which outcome to a degree where they questioned whether there was any choice and consequence at all. And
so not the Telltale system. You will remember this later.
Yeah, but like people joke about that. But like for us, it was like a really strong learning where we said like, ah, okay, you can't take that. You can't take it too far. You need to actually telegraph to the player some form of, you know, this happened because of this. And the question is how elegantly you can do that, whether it's like a UI prompt that literally tells you or, I don't know, the character drops it in the dialogue somehow more subtly, right? And I think this moment between these two characters is actually like really cool situation where everyone got that they're making a big decision here and everyone understood like what comes after is like this big ride of like almost the Witcher 2 kind of approach of two different ending quest lines essentially. And for us it's like it was a really, really big aha moment to kind of go like, yeah, I think we got it now, we figured it out.
What I actually found really interesting about that specific choice was how ambiguous it was in terms of, like, when I made that decision, I wasn't even sure, like, what was the right choice, what was going to happen after. It wasn't like in other games where, like, okay, this choice will obviously lead to this. This choice will obviously lead to this. Now decide which story you want. Yeah. It was more like, okay, do you trust this guy? Do you think this is going to somehow lead to something good? Or do you trust this person? And I think that's very interesting. And we had a question in chat exactly regarding that. Like, how much do you think things like that should be obvious to the player or communicated to the player in terms of what are you really deciding on? Is it cool if it's completely open and the player makes sort of a gut decision in this moment, or do you think, because other games have like a sort of like a description window attached to it that sort of explains it a little more what the choice is.
I think that really
personally, I think that like if it is too morally gray,
yeah,
it actually becomes, I think, kind of unfun for the player, which is I think what we were talking about in that regard. Like if it gets too morally gray,
yeah,
it's hard to understand like what my reward is going to be. And you can reward the player for whatever outcome it is, and you should reward the player for whatever outcome. But I think it's really helpful if you give the player some sort of context going into a decision.
Yeah.
They at least are making a relatively informed choice. And it's not the sort of trolley problem where it's like, no matter what I do, I feel like I'm losing. And so I think that's hard to do. I think it's something that you kind of have to learn how to create experiences that the player can at least generally understand what I think the outcome is going to be. And then when they do that thing, then reward them for it in an appropriate fashion. And then let them know that's how that worked out, was because of the decision they made. I think if you can line up all of those things and do that well, it'll be great.
So we struggled quite a bit, especially on a first project when we were making that, because we made some of the choices with consequences far later into the game, and when the consequences presented themselves, players felt like they were probably cheated a little bit, or they didn't understand what led to what. So we came up with an idea that probably most of the choices should have immediate consequences and then also long-term consequences. And all the context we're providing give a lot of hints about the immediate consequences. What should be happening right now? What they are going into? And there are subtle hints about what will be happening on the grand scale of things. And if you are into narrative, if you are reading it carefully, then you probably know the surprises along the way. If you are not, or if you are not that interested, sometimes that was because of this. And yeah, we also use UI for that. We have a highlighted text that mm-hmm. happened because you did that and that. And,
okay.
A lot of RPGs these days just use that to remind player why this happened, especially if they like a lot of 100 hours long.
Okay. A quick question for you guys. Just what do you prefer more, a predefined character or a completely customized character?
I think it's...
You did both with your last two games.
I mean, kind of, right? Even V is, you know, like, it's not an unwritten piece of paper.
Oh, that's true,
right?
Yeah.
It depends. Like, personally, I like both. It really depends on the ride that the game is taking me for. I'm very happy to either, adopt a persona and just kind of try to play from the perspective of a pre-existing character. Or if I'm giving the complete freedom, like a Baldur's Gate, for example, I just go wild.
Yeah, for me, I'll say completely customizable. I agree. I'm totally fine with both. I think role-playing games can be super successful and super fun with pre-made characters. I love them. But I would say completely customizable.
Mm-hmm.
It's also completely customizable for me, but it's mostly for Western RPGs. If we are talking about JRPGs, that I prefer pre-made ones of the stories.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. So going from the player character to NPCs, because in an RPG, it's not only important that the player character is interesting, you also need NPCs that are interesting and you want to interact with them, and they also need to have specific characters and not just be like a walking quest.
Right. Here, dispenser. Me, for me.
Dispenser, right?
Yeah. So what is important, and how do you make a good NPC character? What to look out for so the player can really like identify with them?
Honestly, I'm level design lead, so like the whole, you know, like there's people much smarter than us do that, you know, deal with doing that. But like one thing that I can say is that I strongly feel that the characters that give the quest are often even more important than what happens in the quest themselves, right? Because this is actually how, like, if you're really mean, you can break any quest down to what I guess people refer to as fetch quests, right? Like any mission that you do at the deepest of its core, at some point goes, please do me a favor so you can get X or whatever, right? And it really is the characters and what happens in it, the gameplay beats, you know, like how the game addresses your sort of like choices and content that you can do, allows you to express yourself in that, that make the content interesting, right? Not necessarily what you have to do specifically, but how it's wrapped up. And I think for Witcher 3, this is what we did a lot with, like, especially the smallest content, where we're trying to at least have the, you know, like, even if the quest was literally like, go, get me my pan. Yeah, a quest that a lot of people liked in the prologue of the game. But we made it cool because the grandma that you talk to, that gives you a task to literally just get her pan from the house, you know, is actually cool and fascinating character to do. And the way Geralt also behaves in the context is interesting and almost comedic, right? But the, like, I think that's really the super important aspect to consider.
Yeah, I think for Obsidian games, at least most of our games, I think because we go for completely customizable main characters, companions become critical because they actually become a component in telling the story. And oftentimes the companion quests and their quest lines and the story that they're going to tell you and how they interact with the main story of the game can be like the most important storytelling moments that we have. And so we really have to think hard from the get-go about what do we want each of those companions to actually sort of address in the story? What is the part that they're telling? You know, and there's some really basic stuff you're going to think about too, like, well, I want a fighter, I want a support character, I want to, you know, whatever the player is not going to pick, I need a companion to fill that role. And how do we do that in an interesting way? Like, because you inevitably on RPGs, you're going to get stuck on tropes, you know, but like, how do you try and defeat that by doing something that feels original and new with that character? And I think, you know, when you're approaching it, those are the big challenges. But you're really kind of solving the same problems, and just getting a really cool cast of companion characters can really bring a game to life. And I think that's what we're usually shooting for.
For companions, I completely agree with you. But also we strive to make companions so they give you some kind of emotion. They could be not always good emotions. Sometimes it's good to hate your companion. Like, you're meeting a companion and he's murdering his own people because of his own reasoning, his solid reasoning. Mm-hmm. And you're doing right things in the moment, but you're completely immoral. I hate you. I will never take you with my party. Please go away. And it different emotion. Or companion could be annoying and like, omni-knowing, always present. Somebody would love him, somebody would hate him, but emotions are great. And for ordinary NPCs, in my opinion, they should be relatable. They should have some problems you do understand or can relate to, like, and translate to your own life. And then when you converse with them and have some small choices during the dialogues, you transfer those choices to yourself and answer from your heart, and that makes them very personal.
Yeah. It's also, in my experience, the companions I like most in RPGs are usually the ones that maybe start out with having like a very different view than I, and there's some sort of conflict happening, but then once you get to know them better and understand what they're all about, then you really start to like them. As opposed to a companion that will from the get-go just be your best friend and help you through everything. That's usually less interesting, I think.
Agreed.
Yeah. Chad has asked regarding that, how important is romancing options for you guys? Since it is always a thing in any RPG, people will always ask, is there romance? Which characters can we romance?
Everybody asks for it. My personal opinion is I can take it or leave it. Like, I think for certain games, it makes sense and is really cool and is and is a fun option that you can build in for companions. But I have never played a role-playing game that, that didn't have romances that I was like, well, that game was crap.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it, it really just depends on the game and what you're trying to accomplish. So that's how I feel about it. I know there's a million people out there that absolutely are like throwing stuff at their monitor right now saying how stupid I am because they want to romance every character. But that's just, you know, that's my opinion.
Not just characters.
Well, yeah.
Wow, I, you know, personally, I always think of like of the context for it, right? I feel in Cyberpunk, for example, the romances are, they have this cool meta layer for it where it's a world that really thrives on isolating the individual, right? Like people are, you know, disconnected from each other by the technology that they use every day, actually, more or less. And there's a certain, like, at least that's how we kind of thought about it, right? There's a certain beauty in, like, despite of how horrible that world is, being able to find moments of intimacy, right? And and developing these feelings between characters and sometimes between players, actually. Yeah. And so I think, you know, if it kind of fits the context of the game and really adds to it, right, I feel it can be a really beneficial tool to do character building also, right? And make the player also feel more connected to the world.
Yeah.
If your game have companions and you're building some sort of relationship with them, then romance become like normal choice, like in life. If you're spending a lot of time alongside with your companion, probably in very difficult situations, sometimes that could lead to some kind of romantic relationship. So if game is like that, we are trying to incorporate these options because it feels natural, not because it's like a drop-down list, you should do romances in your game, but it's interesting to see romances with certain characters in certain situations. Like, for example, there is world ending, and probably this is last thing you will ever do. Who will you choose? How will you spend your last time? It's interesting topic. It brings emotions, and it brings you those decisions you are trying to understand, trying to put yourself in this situation and solve it somehow. And that leads to interesting storytelling. But if game is built up in different way, then romance is not necessary. It's in a way, it's a great tool to highlight your characters and emotions.
Well, it's about taking your characters seriously, right? And not just them being like a playground for the player to do whatever he wants or she wants with them. I had this moment in Baldur's Gate 3, actually, where I was trying to approach Shadowheart, and I didn't say the right things that she wanted to hear, and I think she didn't think I was very sympathetic in that, at that moment, so as like a certain romantic interaction just didn't happen. And that was kind of eye-opening for me, because in some games, like romancing a character means just hit the flirt button whenever it appears, and then we know, okay, you want to romance that NPC? Okay, we give you that option as soon as the right time comes. And I thought that was so cool that they just said, no, you said something she didn't like, so this is not going to happen. Because I really felt like, okay, she's a character they are taking seriously right now. She has her own thoughts and feelings in that moment. So that was cool.
It's not like a coin machine where you just insert coin for romance, right?
Yeah,
like
that's true.
No, we never do that. It's like degrading to characters. It's, I wouldn't like to say work for a romance, but you build up a relationship. It kind of work, and you should understand a character, what particular character likes or dislikes, and probably if as part of his story he just experienced some traumatic events, probably you would not go for it, or your approach will be really different.
So looking at the future of role-playing games, of course we have a lot of technologies that are being developed. AI is more complex than ever. What for you guys is like some of the most interesting things that are going to change role-playing games in the future, looking at your current projects or also just on what you see that is coming up?
Very spicy for me to answer.
I'm sorry, whatever I will say, people will be like,
"Oh, that's Witcher 4."
Yeah. All right. Well, we've seen a tech demo that was not Witcher 4, but showcasing the tech behind Witcher 4, where you guys already showed like a lot of AI systems that were quite advanced. So maybe.
So, from your perspective as a level designer, save myself, like pushing myself on a personal level. What I'd hope to see, right, is that other than, of course, you know, keeping the bar up high for narratives and good characters and stories and our favorite RPGs. I think, even though it's like a very difficult quest for developers, I would love to see worlds generally become more reactive. But like that reactivity also tied into the narrative as well, right? Like, I guess a big example that, you know, it's maybe a negative example even in our own games, is that you have destruction. You can run around and just kind of break stuff. Other than people just kind of going, ooh, no, nothing really happens, right? And I feel like there's the, like, developers in general are probably underutilizing, for good reasons in part, this as a tool in the player's box of toys that they have to mess with the world and cause interactions.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think that's interesting, yeah.
For me personally, kind of technology is a tool to solve a problem for a particular project.
Yeah.
So if you have a great idea in mind and you want, it could be revolutionary, it could be different, then you look for technology to support you. It's not like you're forced to include it in every project. So, and I see that, so for me, it kind of difficult to answer which new technology advances the game, because if there will be a great idea that explores something unimaginable now and you will build technology for that, it will be advancing the game, but we don't know now because our current project are different. And one thing I could suggest is the way we approach narrative in games regarding to if you're playing a game for a long time, you tend to forget a lot of things, especially in big cast of characters. You start to mix them up, especially if you're like playing once in a week or returning to a game. And recently Final Fantasy 16 introduced what they called active time lore, when at any moment you can press a button and it gives you context who these characters are. And you probably meet that particular character at that time, and that particular character is new to you, and it gives you context and brings you back and allow you to be far deeper into narrative than you usually are, especially after a break. It kind of expands on context of terms and context of your choices to context of the whole story, characters and locations. And probably that's a way to go for a complex narrative games to more immerse players deeper into the storylines.
I mean, I would just say, like, I may be getting too old school now. I think that the choice and consequence in narrative that we've offered players, at least in really solid role-playing games, is really good. And I would love to see that continue. And so when I think about technology and tools and what that can sort of bring to that experience, I'm a little less excited about that. I'm a little more excited about what can we do with the world simulation and really bringing the world to life, and making it feel alive around me, but also maybe helping me as a player understand how to navigate that a little bit. One thing in some games that I sort of have grown weary of is getting to the town and feeling like I have to talk to every single person in the town in order to get all the quests and figure out what maybe I need to do there. And like, how can that world simulation help me both feel like I'm in a living, breathing world, but also kind of identify the things that are important around me in like very natural ways. And so, you know, I think those are the kinds of things where I think things will evolve and always be getting better. And I, you know, can't wait to kind of see that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I imagine, yeah, there will be everything. Like we've seen so many steps into that direction for worlds to be more lively. And of course, for a role-playing game, which immersion is like the most important thing, this is going to be very cool.
One of my favorite moments I keep remembering in an RPG game, I guess the last 5 or so years, I was playing Divinity 2 with my wife, and we had like this super cool moment where we had to get into the back of a bar to do an investigation. I think it's relatively at the beginning of the game. And we were struggling so hard because like, oh my God, we have so many options. Like, do we just go and hit the box like for 5 hours and just kind of like get in the key and all that and find the key to get back inside? And my mind was blown at the moment when how we actually ultimately solved it was that literally I was talking to the NPC, and we noticed that with the vision cone and all that, the character would be turning towards me as they talked. And so what I ended up doing is literally just I occupied him with the conversation while my wife snuck in on the back, you know, right behind him and went inside. And like, this is the kind of stuff I mean with this sort of reactivity and interactivity, mm-hmm. right? Giving the player more and more options to not just sort of force choice and consequence through dialogue, but also through gameplay actions, right? Like, and the way they interact with the world. And I think if we can see more of that, like, you know, there will be so many more cool emergent systemic moments that players can have, and like stories like these that players will remember, and I'd love to see that.
Yeah. So Alex, we've talked a lot about like the difference between isometric RPGs and third-person RPGs, and you just made that step from going from an isometric perspective to third-person, really close, defined graphics. What were the most important challenges, and how do you approach it differently?
It changed almost everything because I'm kind of joining from isometric perspective, joining you guys with
joining them.
First of all, when you're writing for isometric, you are writing kind of a little bit like a book, and the story is more slowly paced. You have a lot of space for descriptions. When you go into a third person, you want, you're not going because it just look pretty. You want to have cinematographic experience, and you move from book to movie, and characters start talking differently. Mm. Your expression tools become different palette. And that lead to changes in almost every aspect of production that we had. Apart from, of course, the technical side of things, like just making a lot of prototype to make everything work, combat works, dialogue works. It's a mindset of how you tell a story and how you present choices through different media. And so this kind of was, in my opinion, one of the greatest challenges to start thinking and presenting differently.
Yeah.
That's cool. I had never considered sort of the narrative impact of, like, you know, how you would tell narrative differently depending on the perspective that your game has also. As strongly as that, down to the pacing that you find with it, like down the level of detail and how you can do exposition. For me as a level designer, like the more obvious impact is basically the space you need for the camera and how you need to account for it, right? Like something I brought that in our conversations up quite often, right? Is like when we switch from third person in Witcher 3 to first person in Cyberpunk, we were quite surprised how different the perception of space actually is and what that means for building spaces where now the character enters a room when they enter the room, right? And you don't have to account for the extra space of the camera to also follow into the room and build the room bigger, essentially, right? Or how everything needs to be more detailed because players are much closer looking at things, right?
Yeah. or even when character makes some remark or interrupt, you have to have space for that, because in isometric you can just pop up something over the head and it works. And now you are just moving through the corridor or through the room, and you have to have space to pronounce those words, and they should be relevant to the environment around you. It kind of make planning far more detailed and essential at the earliest stages of production.
Okay, we're almost done. I have one last question from chat. You guys can answer very quickly. What is your favorite RPG that you didn't work on yourself? Or maybe you can't answer quickly because it's hard.
It's hard.
You can answer. You can answer
just
also
like,
with that.
Like my gut feeling just says Mass Effect series.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good one. I would pick Mass Effect 2 out of those. I mean, Baldur's Gate 3 is the most recent one that I played that was pretty stunning, and the companion stories were really fantastic. I would have to think about this one for a while. It's like playing that game. What's your five games?
Yeah, I know. Like, it's hard.
It's like, I need, Chad is I need always to write asking, a book about this. Like,
Chad is always asking the hard questions.
No, but I guess like I have to say on a German stage is Gothic, of course, right? Like,
yeah, we've had a lot of Gothic fans in chat also. Yeah, I would also say Mass Effect, which of course is cool because you're sort of getting in that direction with your new
thank
game.
You.
So excited
please
for that one.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. For me, it changes every time because a lot of great games comes and it just picks up first spot. So for now, probably for me, Persona 5 and with Clair Obscur Expedition 33 being very close contender.
Yeah, that was so good. What an exciting surprise this year. Yeah. I love
great
that game.
Great year for the games.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. It was an honor to talk to you guys and very interesting. Thanks for coming along.
Thanks for having us.
And good luck with your future projects. I hope they all go very well. Excited for The Expanse, Osiris Reborn.
Thank you.
Bring back a Mass Effect style games.
Thank you.
excited to see what's next for Grounded 2. You're on Early Access right now, right?
Yeah, that's right. We've got a lot of cool stuff coming up. Very exciting. Yeah. Not a typical role-playing game or role-playing light survival, right?
Yeah.
And that whole what is the role-playing game conversation. Not really one. But yeah, we've got a lot of cool stuff coming out.
Yeah. And of course, excited for Witcher 4 also. Whenever you're ready to show something, hit us up.
Yeah, we'll wait till we're ready.
Thank you. Okay, vielen Dank fürs Zuschauen. Ich hoffe, euch hat es auch ein bisschen gefallen. Ich fand es auf jeden Fall sehr, sehr cool und habe mich gefreut, das hier hosten zu dürfen. Vielen Dank fürs Zuschauen.